Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the backstory of the AIDS epidemic, chronic fatigue syndrome, the new drug Truvada, and more medical misinformation. How bad is the science underlying much of what we have been told about AIDS? Who's responsible? Why has there been virtually zero coverage in the mainstream media, not a single article about gay-on-gay attacks, attacking people's character, attacking their reputations because they chose to investigate the HIV/AIDS phenomena and came up with different questions and different perspectives? Leading this story today is Charles Ortlieb. Charles is one of the most distinguished and respected gay journalist in the world. In fact, his publication, The New York Native, was the number one read New York Native and for almost 16 years, from 1980 to 1996. It was gay biweekly. The Native was the first major publication to take the AIDS epidemic seriously and question aspects of the AIDS hypothesis. No one then and no one now is questioning that AIDS is real. It is. No one's questioning the HIV plays a role, but how much of a role? And a lot of people, over 3,000 scientists from around the world, some of the most distinguished scientists, including multiple Nobel Prize winners in science, state that there are things about the war on AIDS that are simply wrong. I wrote several articles myself, starting in 1984 and continuing for almost 30 years on what I found problematic. More importantly, I spent my time, just for anyone who's not aware of this, focusing upon how to work with people with AIDS who were HIV infected through the Tri-State Healing Center. That was the largest complementary medical center in America for years and years, as well as a scientist research fellow in anti-aging medicine. I was the director of the Department of Anti-Aging Medicine at the Institute of Applied Biology. At both institutions, we were able to successfully work with people with AIDS, successfully meaning we were able to keep people alive, to improve their health, to reduce many of their opportunistic infections. In fact, no one died, not a single one of the 1,200 people I work with in a 15-year period. Not one died. Our medical staff, board-certified physicians and nurses and nurse practitioners, kept methodical records. With the patient's permission, those records were shown to journalists, African-American journalists such as Tony Brown and Bill McCrary, the multi-Emmy award-winning reporter, investigative journalist at Channel 5, to Earl Caldwell, to Doug Henderson, to the publisher of the Amsterdam News, Bill Tatum. In fact, multiple people in the African-American community came to the center. We were open 7 days a week, and generally in the evening, and there would be about 90% of the people after about 2 years were African-American or Latino. And they would encourage them, Stokely Carmichael, Isaac Hayes, Arthur Ashe. They were interested in what we were doing. I created protocols based upon intravenous vitamin C, ozone, herbs, homeopathics, juicing, and a variety of other exercises, including positive psychological input, so that just the diagnosis alone, a person would not end up crushing their immune system because of the fear of dying from AIDS. I asked a group, would you like to do an accelerated protocol? Of the 1,200 people, 8 said yes. There was actually 12, but then 4 of them decided it was too rigorous, and they dropped out. And the protocol consisted of coming to the center 6 days a week for 4 hours and take the highest therapies, potent therapies. You're talking about 200,000 milligrams of vitamin C alone. And we tested them every 4 weeks. Roche Labs, the standard lab for all hospitals and medical offices, drew their blood, and we would analyze it, and you could see a progression from disease and virals different types, not just HIV, but also hepatitis, herpes 1, 2, and 6, and cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, all of these came down. Of those eight, at the end of 16 months, every single one had seroconverted to negative. More importantly, they also no longer had any opportunistic infections, no pneumocystis, green pneumonia, no Kaposi sarcoma, nothing. They were ideally healthy, and we monitored them for the next 3 years, and they maintained their health and seronegative conversion. This was brought to the attention of the media only in the African-American community. I appeared on Tony Brown's Journal 6 times with the people and their medical records, and it took months before they would invite me on so that they could review this, make sure that these people actually had improved. I published the longest article in the Townsend Letter for Physicians and Patients in their history on natural treatment stays. I wrote a textbook, the largest chapter, over 160 pages, on natural treatments for AIDS. I published several other articles on the topic. I did a press conference on it, where 100 people with full-blown AIDS, not just my therapies, but are all across the country, it took us a year to do this, who were making improvements in long-term survivors using natural and non-toxic methods, appeared. We did a press conference at the Walter Reed Theater at Lincoln Center, packed house, where people in the audience who had been on natural protocols from around the United States appeared and gave evidence. We did 16 hours at a church, the largest church on Central Park West, where all day long people from around the world were brought in to share their therapies. I brought people in from China, scientists from Italy, from France, from Japan. Now, with all this, you would think that someone within the AIDS community, some of the thousands of foundations, the government agencies, would come and find out what we were doing. We had an open-door policy. Not once, not a single time, did any of these people ever show up. In fact, the only thing they could say is, I must be an AIDS denier, because I questioned the strictly pharmaceutical toxic drug approach like AZT. I was engaged in debates with the leading physicians using AZT at New York Medical Center. I debated 4 of them. I was opposed to AZT because I had the records to show how toxic it was, and it wasn't a good experiment. So that's my participation. At the Institute of Applied Biology, I reverse seroconverted because they were not succeeding with the regular medical staff there. And I was asked, would I help? They set up a special lab with drip rooms, nurses' stations, and the protocols. In 2 years, 10 people seroconverted. And I have full documentation of that, including letters from the senior research fellow at the Institute. And 8, that's 18 people, were AIDS-free and completely healthy, and I never charged a penny. Every one of those people were treated for free. I paid for their therapy out of my own pocket. So that's my own particular experience, and I wanted to share that with you before we begin, because the rest of this program is about Charles Ortlieb. In any case, Charles did a phenomenal job of looking at everything possible with his award-winning reporter, Nina Ostrom. He interviewed people others would not interview, like Peter Duisberg. He also published John Lawrenson's investigative report on the deadly effects of AIDS drug AZT, and was also the first to cover the chronic fatigue syndrome epidemic, which has been called an epidemic of non-HIV AIDS. For a decade, the biweekly reported on chronic fatigue syndrome. Much of the reporting focused on human herpes 6. He was the only person that I was aware of was focusing on that, the virus that links AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome. Rolling Stone's journalist David Black claimed Charles Ortlieb's New York native deserved a Pulitzer Prize. I concur. Chuck also had written several novels and plays, including the novel Iron Peter. His book on the history of the New York native and its role in the coverage of AIDS is The Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Epidemic Cover-Up. The book has been on Amazon AIDS bestseller list for almost 2 years. His newest book, which comes out next week, is called Susan Sontag as Metaphor, which is about his complicated relationship with a famous intellectual and how she ignored warnings and betrayed the gay community in her famous book, AIDS and the Metaphors. You can find more information about Chuck and his books and writings at charlesortlieb.com. Nice to have you with us today, Charles.
Hi, Gary.
I would like for you to take your time, please, and go through your history of working on the AIDS issues and being the number one publication on AIDS and for gays in the United States, how you went from that position to being mocked, ridiculed, denigrated, attacked, slandered, libeled, and in effect had to close down the publication because of the people within the gay community who attacked you. And this is a story no journalist has dared touch. Today you have a chance to share those insights. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Okay, thank you, Gary. You know, in 1980, I was running a literary magazine called Christopher Street, and we were having financial troubles, and I was trying to figure out a way to stay in business, so I got the crazy idea of starting a gay newspaper to try and save the gay literary magazine. And the gay newspaper was the New York Native, and we started publishing at the end of 1980. And when I started the newspaper, I hadn't been a journalist before, and suddenly I had to find stories to put on the cover. And the first story happened immediately, which was that a man named Ronald Crumpley shot two gay men in a bar, and that was our first cover story. But after that, I didn't have to worry about what we were going to put on the cover, because within 6 months, this mysterious illness started breaking out in gay men in New York, and it was terrifying at the time, and the whole community was terrified. But I decided that we would make it our signature story, and we would not look away. We were one of the few publications, gay or otherwise, that covered the epidemic for the first 2 years. The first person that covered it for us was Dr. Larry Mass. And initially, most of what we did in our coverage was basically repeat whatever the CDC, said was happening. We were sort of like stenographers, and we were very trusting of what was coming out of the CDC. Until I started noticing some discrepancies in things that they said, and our reporting started to get more investigative, and we started looking at the possibility that that they were not telling the truth about the epidemiology of AIDS. And I had a couple of reporters who, like Ann Fettner, who caught the CDC lying about the what was going on in Florida, that the CDC was not taking seriously the number of cases. There were cases that were outside the gay community in Florida, which suggested that the epidemic wasn't being spread the way that the CDC said it was being spread. And as you know, eventually they decided that HIV was the cause of AIDS. And what bothered me about that was that the science was being done by Robert Gallo, and I was becoming aware that Gallo had done a number of things that were quite questionable in his laboratory, that he had been accused of basically stealing other people's work, this even before HIV. So when it turned out that Gallo was behind HIV, we wondered whether HIV would turn out to be another questionable finding. And as you know, it eventually did turn out to be a questionable finding. And we reported all of that, and that's when we started to get into trouble with the CDC, because they expected us to just basically repeat whatever they said was happening in AIDS. And that's when the gay community started to get nervous about what we were doing, because we were doing investigative reporting, and what they basically wanted was reassurance that everything that was coming out of the CDC was believable. So that's more or less how the trouble began.
Early findings were, and when the controversies with people within the gay community who had aligned themselves with the Gallo group and Fauci group who were running the AIDS war, and then the institutions that arose because the pharmaceutical companies were funding them and whoever got funded suddenly was in a line with the pharmaceutical philosophy and the Washington consensus against the truth.
Well, as you know, we got into a lot of trouble when John Lauritzen started digging into the research on AZT and found out that a lot of the studies were conducted fraudulently. And in a whole series of articles, he made the case that the treatment was worse than the disease and that AZT was killing people. And this is at a time when the AIDS activist group ACT UP was trying to get the government to make AZT for free. So here's us saying AZT is killing people, and there's ACT UP saying we want it for free. So there was a little problem there. and John, you know, John, by the way, is the person who really put Peter Duesberg on the map. I mean, he did the first big interview with Peter. We put him on the cover. And, you know, I was quite impressed with Peter's intelligence. As you know, he was slated to eventually win a Nobel Prize. That's the caliber of his work at that time. He was one of the world's leading retrovirologists, and he basically said, the science doesn't add up. This can't be the cause. And you know, initially Peter Duesberg said that he didn't really know what the cause was. I only bring that up because everyone always thinks that Peter immediately thought that drugs and lifestyle were the cause of AIDS, but not initially. And I've actually written a book about Peter called Peter Duesberg and the Duesbergians, and I make the case that if Peter had just stuck with saying that the science does not support HIV as the cause of AIDS, and we need to go back to the beginning and look again to see what the cause is, I think Peter would not have suffered the consequences he did. But he connected his doubts about HIV to a theory that drugs are the cause of AIDS. And by the way, I do not believe that. I want to make that crystal clear. I think AIDS is caused by a virus, and that the politics of AIDS are about hiding what the real virus is and its relationship to chronic fatigue syndrome. So I'm sort of, you know, Peter is a glass half full for me. I call him half a hero, but I say half a hero is better than none. I support a lot of what his supporters, well, his followers, have written about what's going on with the epidemic, but I don't support the idea that this is a lifestyle epidemic. I think this is a pandemic, and it's connected to chronic fatigue syndrome, and it's an epic problem that still hasn't been dealt with.
Let's back up a moment before we get to that, which okay. We will get to. How did your dissent go down with the gay network of AIDS activists?
Well, I did a cover that said, should Gallo and Essex be in jail early on in the epidemic? And I did it after learning how dishonest Gallo's science was and how Max Essex had hidden the fact that one of his discoveries didn't exist. And these were the two bigwigs in AIDS research. So I did this cover, should Gallo and Essex be in jail? And the day that that issue came out, I got a call from an important person in the gay community. He was a lawyer. He had been an editor. I had known him for some time, and he asked, you know, to have a drink with me. He wanted to talk with me. So I met him, and the first thing he did is pull out a copy of the Gallo issue, and he said, you must stop doing this. And I said to him, I'm just getting started. And, you know, that was sort of the beginning of me, you know, and the main so-called mainstream New York gay community, you know, being at odds about how to proceed on covering the epidemic, you know. I wanted to do investigative reporting, you know, and get to the truth, you know. And I think they wanted to be able to trust the government. They wanted to be able to work with the government. And I think that was a big mistake then, and it's a bigger mistake now.
What were the efforts made to destroy your reputation?
You know, it came a little bit, you know, later. As you know, ACT UP voted to boycott us in the final years of our existence, And it did hurt us. I mean, we survived it for a long time, but after a couple of years, we went out of business. But, you know, ACT UP, you know, the moment that I knew there was something was wrong with AIDS activism was at a presidential, it was a hearing of the Presidential Commission on AIDS, something like that. Matilda Krim was there. It was in New York, and Peter Duesberg was speaking there. And it was a packed audience. It was someplace on the East Side. And when Peter Duesberg got up to make his points about HIV, it was the AIDS activists who stood up and booed him. And that really bothered me because I thought, you know, we need all the freedom of speech we can get in this epidemic. I mean, that's become a very big issue to me, a kind of totalitarian environment we're now living in, where this epidemic is concerned, where anyone who opens their mouth is in trouble. You know, and I think in terms of the science, anyone who comes up with research that really challenges the fundamentals of the epidemic will have trouble getting published. They'll have trouble getting a hearing from the scientific community. And I think that the AIDS activists should be promoting, you know, a transparency, the First Amendment in science. I mean, there is no First Amendment in AIDS science. You know, you either toe the line or you're out. And that includes, you know, journalists, scientists, doctors, gay people. It's one big group of lemmings these days. And it's a very dangerous situation. But not only for the gay community. You know, the whole country now, I think, is at risk for what's being hidden here. The chronic fatigue syndrome epidemic is huge. And I can't even tell you, you know, how many people have it because the CDC refuses to do serious science about it. And I think it's apparent that they don't want the public to panic about chronic fatigue syndrome. And, you know, and based on our reporting, I think what they don't want the public to panic about is that chronic fatigue syndrome is non-HIV AIDS. And the other problem is that non-HIV AIDS means that HIV is probably not the cause of AIDS, period. And that's where we are right now. That's the problem.
Let's hold on 1 second, Charles. You're leading us into an area where we have to have a lot more basics. So let's not jump into this. You've been into it for decades. The average person listening is starting from scratch. They haven't heard a word on this. This has not been published in any of the gay publications or the AIDS publications. So trace the history of the first thoughts of it being herpes 6 and then later chronic fatigue syndrome. Take us on a journey. Don't take us from kindergarten to graduate college. Take us step by step, all right?
Okay, well, and then in order to talk about the history of herpes 6, we got to talk about the history of African swine fever virus, because that's where this all began. In 1983, Jane Tease, who was a researcher working at Harvard, published a letter in The Lancet saying that she thought that the best hypothesis, or a good hypothesis for the cause of AIDS, was that it was African swine fever virus that had spread into Haiti and the Dominican Republic and Brazil in the late 70s, and that it had somehow spread to our country, and that the disease had many things in common with AIDS. And I thought it was a brilliant hypothesis, and I put it on the cover of my magazine, my newspaper, and subsequently it just caused such a hostile reaction at the CDC and the USDA, and even in the gay community, that I thought, you know, the lady doth protest too much. And, you know, subsequently, she fought the USDA to get her idea tested, and she and a scientist named John Beldekis got blood from a group of AIDS patients, and they had it tested for African swine fever in England, and a significant number of the AIDS cases were positive for African swine fever. You know, and that's a virus, it's just not supposed to be in people. And they published it, and, you know, and all hell broke loose. The CDC and the USDA did their own study and said they couldn't find it, and that, you know, they basically tried to bury it. But during that period, John Beldekis went down to Gallo's lab, and he made a presentation on African swine fever to them. And according to John, Gallo was quite intrigued by African swine fever, and he said, oh, now I understand why you people think it's the cause of AIDS. But nothing happened as a result of that, except that 6 months later, Gallo's people discovered what is now called HHV6. And John Beldeckis, who is now dead, always suspected that Gallo had basically, you know, appropriated their work and renamed African swine fever HHV6. So we kept our eye on HHV6, which, by the way, he found both in AIDS patients and chronic fatigue syndrome patients. That's where those two epidemics really came together, was in that finding. So you know, we decided, well, let's just focus on HHV6. We're not going to be able to show that it's connected to pigs or African swine fever because the CDC and the USDA just will not cooperate on this, but let's just keep our eye on HHV6. So Nina Ostrom's reporting for the next decade basically, you know, showed that HHV6 could do everything that HIV was supposed to do and more, and that it was more likely the real pathogen that was causing the damage, not only in AIDS, but also in chronic fatigue syndrome. So this was not, you know, this was not going down well with the CDC or Anthony Fauci, the AIDS czar, you know, or any of the AIDS establishment. But we kept reporting on HHV6. We published 3 books by Nina on the subject. I got Nicholas Wade at ABC News to do a big piece on it, but they continue to look the other way.
Now take us to what you found about human herpes 6 and when you first began to notice a correlation with chronic fatigue syndrome.
The first chronic fatigue syndrome researchers in Incline Village thought that maybe HHV6, or HBLV as it was called then, you know, what was the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome. I was in touch with somebody who ran a lab out in Incline Village where there was a cluster of cases, a big cluster of cases, and he was telling me that they actually could look at sort of the serology of the town. And they noticed that they went the town. If they looked back, the blood samples they had in the town went from zero positivity to HHV6 to like 90% or something like that. So you really had the impression that HHV6 had entered Incline Village, you know, and caused this epidemic. The problem with HHV6 turned out to be that it is, you know, it's so easily transmitted that it's now widespread, and it makes it difficult to distinguish between cases and controls, because, you know, everyone who has an HHV6 problem won't necessarily be manifest as AIDS or chronic fatigue syndrome, because it's really, you know, it's 40 years now. I was 30 really when we did our first story on AIDS. I'm now going to be 70. So, you know, whatever was happening in 1980 has now, you know, spread throughout the general population. And so the HHV6 chronic fatigue syndrome problem has gotten much bigger. And that's why I think the CDC still will not do serious research on chronic fatigue syndrome, because all the research always leads back to AIDS. You know, I mean, and the other problem is that the chronic fatigue syndrome community doesn't really want to talk about the connection to AIDS, because they saw what happened to the AIDS patients. They don't want to be stigmatized. They don't want to be pariahs. They don't want to be a notifiable disease. You know, AIDS is a notifiable disease. I mean, chronic fatigue syndrome is clearly infectious, contagious, whatever, and should be a notifiable disease, and it's not. If the CDC started to do that, they probably would cause some kind of a panic in the country, because no one wants to think of chronic fatigue syndrome as being a contagious disease. You know, and yet many of the partners, sexual partners of CFS patients have come down with the disease. You know, entire families have come down with it.
Charles, show us step by step the similarities and the connectivity between AIDS, the syndrome, and also chronic fatigue. What do they have in common? If you were an honest scientist, physician, examining a patient who has been diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, what would they have in common with a person with AIDS?
The list is long. you could start with brain lesions are similar. You could start with the natural killer cell problems. You could tell, you know, I would say multi-systemic and variable pathological issues. Every system of the body is affected in both illnesses. T cells are affected, the macrophages are affected, the B cells are affected, the endothelial cells are affected. The list is long and getting longer. I have created what I called Ortlieb's rule. And Ortlieb's rule is that if you're doing chronic fatigue syndrome research, you shouldn't just compare your cases to controls. You should compare your chronic fatigue syndrome cases to controls and to AIDS patients. You know, in other words, if you're doing a study, on B cells in chronic fatigue syndrome, you should study the B cells in the patients and in the healthy controls, and also in the AIDS patients, so that you can tell us whether there's a real difference between AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome. I've called for something called the CFS AIDS New Deal, which calls for equal funding for AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome research, and that they should be researched side by side to determine if they're really one variable epidemic. If people want to see the list of things that are similar between the two illnesses, just read Nina's three books that they can find on Amazon, or Hillary Johnson's Osler's Web, which is also on Amazon.
Charles, we are spending more on AIDS, have spent more on AIDS research than on cancer. The latest figure I have is around $800 billion. Now, considering how much money we're spending, what is the best that we can say about the science? What have they found? And what is the most inappropriate research that does not help us in this context?
Well, I think I use the term malware to describe what is going on. That it's like there is malware at the very center of all this. So that it's a garbage in and garbage out to a certain degree, and we really need to go back to the basics of the nosology of the disease, how you define the disease, before you start counting the cases and doing epidemiology. Do you have the correct definition of the disease? And my argument is they should have factored in chronic fatigue syndrome. By the way, in my book, The Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Epidemic Cover-Up, I talk about the fact that I found a doctor back in the 80s, at the same time that AIDS was going on, who worked in Atlanta, probably just blocks away from the CDC, and at that time, he was seeing cases of people with immune dysfunction that turned out to be chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, I think it certainly went through his head that it was odd that he was seeing these cases in heterosexuals, mainly, I assume, by the way, that he was seeing these cases of immune dysfunction at the same time the AIDS epidemic was occurring. Now, the CDC, was made aware of these cases, but they did not factor them in to their epidemiology on AIDS, and I think that's where the big... that was the malware moment. That was the big mistake. It's like you should never talk about AIDS without talking about chronic fatigue syndrome or non-HIV AIDS. That's what needs to be done. That's what should have been done. That's the source of all the problems.
Let's go over to another issue. I believe you have something new and possibly very important to talk about, Kaposi sarcoma, which was one of the two defining illnesses or the symptoms, along with pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, that would get you a definite diagnosis of AIDS. Talk about Kaposi sarcoma today and what the science is now showing.
Oh, this is wild. I think I discovered this a year ago. But there's a company called Epiphany Biosciences in California, and it is owned by, run by a man named Fred Valinsky. And this company was started, you know, 10 or 15 years ago by Fred Valinsky and, drum roll, Robert Gallo, okay? Now, this company is trying to do two things. The first thing is they have a drug that might be effective against HHV6, okay? Which is interesting, considering Gallo's involved. But they also are trying to develop a state-of-the-art test for Kaposi sarcoma virus, HHV8. And so I started looking at their grant proposal for, they got a $2 million grant, I believe, from NIH for their research. And in the proposal, it says that, in some high-risk populations, such as homosexual men, the HHV8 or KS virus prevalence is as high as 65%. Okay, that's the KS virus. 65% of gay men. I mean, I was shocked. And when I saw that, I had to get in touch with Valinsky, you know, and I had a number of conversations with him. And I've talked to his chief researcher on KS, whose name is Enrique Mesri. And Enrique is probably, you know, one of the leading KS experts now in the country. And he's very concerned that there is a coming huge epidemic of Kaposi sarcoma because of these numbers. Okay, that's one thing. The other thing is that the AIDS drugs are supposed to prevent this from happening, the Kaposi sarcoma. They're not working for this. People who are on the AIDS drugs are still getting Kaposi sarcoma. And the third thing is they have not informed the gay men that 65% of them, you know, that 65% of them have this virus that's associated with this cancer. And by the way, it's associated with something called Castleman's disease and God only knows what else, because in some ways the research is still very young on KS. But it's an oncogenic virus, and it's transmitted by kissing. And you know, you don't see any public health warnings that about HHV8 or Kaposi sarcoma virus. They're just completely looking the other way on this. And I think the reason that the CDC and Tony Fauci have been looking the other way is they know that this could completely undermine everything that they're telling the public about AIDS. That you know, they separated Kaposi sarcoma and HIV years ago, and I think that's going to turn out to be a big mistake. They should have never separated KS from AIDS. You know, I used to talk to a doctor in Miami who was seeing lots of AIDS patients from Haiti and gay patients and whatnot, and it was back in the early part of the epidemic when people were still doing autopsies. And he told me that every single AIDS patient on autopsy had KS internally, that they could find KS in everybody. His theory was this is the central event of AIDS, KS. And, you know, and unfortunately, you know, years later they separated the two politically, AIDS from KS. You know, and so flash forward to today, and now, you know, they've allowed the KS virus, supposedly, to spread to the point where 65% of gay men, according to Gallo's company's, you know, research proposal, you know, have the KS virus. I think this is going to be a huge story, Gary. I mean, I can see what's coming. This, by the way, this doctor, Enrique Mesri, you know, agrees with me that this probably should be a notifiable disease, the HHV8 virus. So how would you like to have to tell, like, 65% of gay men, oh, you know, we've got AIDS under control, but now we need to report you as being a carrier of the Kaposi sarcoma virus. I think this is going to be explosive politically, and sooner rather than later, because from my discussions with Mesri, there's just a growing concern about this. Anyway, did I make that
yeah,
story clear?
Yes.
Okay.
Now let's go to another story, Truvada, T-R-U-V-A-D-A. This is a drug that I see advertised everywhere. And on is for gay men and women and persons at risk for HIV. Why should the gay community be worried about this new drug?
Well, the side effects are pretty scary. I mean, it can affect bone density. It can affect cause kidney disease. You know, they're trying to downplay it and saying, oh, it's just a small percentage of people that will have this, you know, these side effects. But it doesn't seem so small to me. And, you know, and what's going to happen 10 years or 20 years, you know, from now on this drug that is, you know, affecting, you know, 4 or 5, whatever it is, percentage of the people right now? You know, I don't think that we're in a state where, I don't think gay people are being given informed consent about this drug. They're not being told what the long-term implications are. They're also not being told that the people giving this drug are basing it on science that may have, you know, be fundamentally fraudulent. You know, I mean, it really does matter. It really does matter whether HIV or HHV6, or what I call the HHV6 family of viruses, whether HIV or HHV6 is the cause of AIDS. It really does matter in terms of the treatment, in terms of the prevention you do, and the public is not being told about the real nature of the epidemic. And they're also, you know, and the HHVA thing factors in here too, because, you know, they're basically telling people, oh, you know, you can take these, you know, this preventative drug and, you know, and you'll be fine. But you know what? HHV8 is spread through kissing. They're not telling people about, you know, the fact that you could get the Kaposi sarcoma virus from kissing. You know, what really concerns me about Truvada right now is that, as you may be aware of, in the last couple of weeks, the AIDS activists are trying to shut down the lawyers who are putting ads on Facebook, apparently, trying to find people who have been harmed by Truvada. And they're afraid that these ads are scaring people away from taking Truvada. So they want to control the information about Truvada, which I just think is very disturbing. People need to know about, you know, people who have been harmed by Truvada. And Gary, by the way, I suggest you really should try to get some lawyers and some of the patients on your show and start discussing what's going on out there. There's a lot of lawyers. There are a lot of patients. And I have not talked to anybody who's involved in the litigation. I've talked to some assistants to the lawyers, but I haven't talked to any of the actual victims. But I bet you that there's some very angry people out there. And, you know, even though they're probably going to win a lot of money in these cases, you know, I assume that a lot of their lives are ruined by this. And I just think that this, you know, this is going to be a new activist group that we need to hear from. You know, rather than hearing from the AIDS activists that everything is just fine with the science, everything is just fine with Truvada, let's hear from the people who have been harmed by Truvada. And let's hear from the lawyers, you know, and maybe these lawyers will start to dig deeper. You know, maybe there's more lawsuits to come about the whole foundation of the epidemic. You know, we need some smart lawyers to figure out how to basically sue our way to the truth about all this.
What role, if any, does Robert Gallo play in the HAV8 scare that is currently occurring?
Unfortunately, by the way, all these guys are getting very old. So it's like, you know, whether it's Fauci or Gallo, you know, we're not, you know, these guys aren't, you know, going to be around that much longer to take the blame. You know, most of Gallo's bad deeds are, you know, have been done in the past. I don't think he is, you know, terribly active right now, although I have a feeling if you got him on the phone, he would start ranting and raving, you know, about Peter Duesberg and, you know, and how wrong everybody is, and HIV is a truck and it just kills people instantly. And, you know, I've called him a sociopath. He's, you know, if you read John Crutzen's book, Science Fictions, you have to come to a conclusion very similar to that one. He just lies so easily. You know, I've actually thought he's somewhat like Trump in that respect. He just has a real problem with the truth.
Be specific. He appeared on my show with Luc Montagnier, and after I started asking some polite but serious questions, he just hung up. I thought that's strange. You know, if he was that confident in his answers, he should have just given us his answers. He was not being attacked. He was just questions I generally don't hear people ask him. So be specific. If you say that he's lied and he lies easily, give us examples.
You know, they falsified a lot of the data on HIV in order to make it look like they discovered the virus, and the French did not. You know, the photographs were altered in his lab. He knows how to play the game. He prevents other scientists from getting published. He was sent an article on AIDS by Luc Montagnier to edit for Science magazine, and he changed the basic conclusions of the article. I really recommend John Crutzen's Science Fiction, which is a 700-page book. I mean, he goes over just everything that happened in Gallo's lab. The funniest thing about Gallo's lab is that one of his top AIDS researchers, instead of keeping neat notebooks the way most scientists do about what they're doing, he would keep his data on little pieces of paper that were crumpled up and put in a drawer. The laboratory was not only dishonest, it was just this total, you know, a total mess. You know, it looked like a hoarder was running it or something. I mean, it was just, I can't wait to see the movie on Gallo. I mean, he's gotten away with this. He knows how to, he knows power politics. You know, I'm impressed with that about him. But I'm amazed that people, you know, admire him in any way, because, I mean, just look at Science Fictions, and the whole history is there.
Charles, let me share something from my own personal experience. There was a multi-award-winning journalist, one of the most respected journalists in the world, by the way, from Great Britain. Her name was Virginia Roberts, I believe it was. And she was the one who discovered blood diamonds. She was the one who broke the story on Aboriginal children being taken away from their parents, put in boarding school, then adopted by non-Aboriginal parents. She did dozens of these. And she was able to obtain from, what was his name, Durovic, who was kind of the head of the National Cancer Institute's lab where Gallo was the director. And while Gallo, so she says, Gallo was in France at the Institut Pasteur talking about his antibody test, to see whether or not you had the HIV virus, he was given the final article that was to appear in Science magazine, and he had the head of the National Cancer Institute's electron microscope division tell him that there was no unique virus, but rather viral debris. And he also found that he had not discovered the cause of HIV. And this was in the report. And when Gallo came back, he scribbled notes on all this. I've seen the actual notes, handwritten notes by Gallo, changing the entire content and context of the article. And that's what got published. But no one knew this. And evidently this person sent a relative, I believe it was his sister in a European country, the original document, so he had before and after. And that's what Roberts was able to obtain. When she compared the before and after, she was startled by the idea that what science published was not what the actual science proved. And then a group of dozens of scientists signed a letter to Science magazine to retract Gallo's article. They never got a response, by the way. That's what the story I was told. What were you told about that?
That just sounds like another chapter in the biography of Robert Gallo. I mean that's typical of the kind of things that he did. I truly believe that history will decide that Gallo is a man without a conscience, and that is the big problem at the center of this. He really didn't care enough about the truth at any point. He wanted a Nobel Prize. He's been people have described him as saying that to them personally. That's what he wanted in his life. And he was luckily deprived of that. But that's what drove this man. Gary, can I just tell you about some sort of a breaking news story that I just think you should know about? And it's going to go back to African swine fever for a second. But I don't know whether you're keeping up with this or not, but African swine fever virus, I think has killed, is now spreading in China, and it has killed like 40% of the pigs. It's not under control. And it is spread to Vietnam and the Philippines, and it is it has spread throughout. It's spread from Russia into Eastern Europe, and it's now on the border of Poland and Germany. And it probably is in Germany as we speak, but they have not declared it an epidemic yet. But it's on the border. It's a disease that infects wild boar. So the chances are very good that wild boar went over the border to Germany, and that it's going to hit Germany any minute. So it's probably going to spread throughout Western Europe. And it's a disease that does not have a vaccine or a treatment. And generally, they start killing the pigs in the country as soon as they find it in the country. They basically have to repopulate farms, kill all the pigs, and then repopulate it with healthy pigs. Anyway, it is it's expected to hit the United States very, very soon. 22% of the pork that is confiscated in Australia that's coming in via flights from other countries is positive for African swine fever, so it's expected to break out in Australia. We are looking for African swine fever virus here. When planes arrive, there are dogs that sniff out pork, but if 22% of the pork coming into Australia is infected with African swine fever, then probably an interesting percentage of pork coming into the United States is infected with African swine fever. So the odds that this virus is going to break out here soon are very good. And this is going to reopen the whole Jane Tees question about whether or not African swine fever can make people sick. And what you should know about what has happened in the last 20 years since Jane Tees left the scene is there have been a couple of studies that have shown one study detected novel sequences related to African swine fever virus in human serum and sewage in Mississippi, and another study found viral sequences similar to African swine fever in people with fevers from Nicaragua. So this whole business that African swine fever virus doesn't and can't infect people may be total baloney. So this is another way that the whole AIDS story could, be reopened in a new way very soon. If African swine fever virus breaks out here, it will have an enormous impact on the economy, by the way. And not only regarding pork products, but all farm products immediately become suspected of carrying the virus. It's a very hardy virus. It can live on crops. It can survive freezing. It spreads very easily. So it'll be on the front pages.
Charles, we're out of time, but one last quick short answer, please.
Yes.
I believe that you had written that you believe we need a new second Stonewall, or what you call the new gay renaissance of truth seekers. Could you explain that very briefly?
Well, I think the gay community is in a new state of oppression. I think that the gay community has been lied to for 4 decades. They're now being turned into a toxic dump by Truvada. They're on the brink of a Kaposi sarcoma epidemic that no one will tell them the truth about. So I think, you know, I think we do need a new Stonewall, but we need a smart Stonewall. We don't need a lemming Stonewall. I mean, what AIDS activism has turned the gay community into a bunch of lemmings. You know, we need critical thinkers. We need, you know, independent minds, and we need courage. You know, people have to be brave enough to speak up and say, you know, that much of what we've been told about AIDS is not true. You know, so that's
well. Speaking for myself, I appreciate what you, Nina, and the staff, John Lawrence and others for the New York Native, did, the sacrifices you made, and the truth you continue to tell today. Hopefully that renaissance occurs, and you're one of the wise men at 70 helping guide it. Thank you very much, Charles Ortley, for being on today.
Thank you, Gary.
Charles's website is charlesortleb.com. His book is The Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Epidemic Cover-Up and Susan Sontag as Metaphor. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.